Today is June 21st, 2012. This is Desiree Hargis on behalf of the H.J. Lutcher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project, I'm interviewing Steve Netburn over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. Steve, can you start out with when and where you were born and what your full birth name is?
My full birth name is Stephen Jeffrey Netburn. I was born in New York City in 1943, July 12th.
July 12th. And, correct. Oh, your birthday is coming up.
Yes, it is. I'll be 69.
Ah, wonderful. And did you grow up in New York?
I did. Not until I went off to university at the University of Pennsylvania did I leave, and I almost never came back again after that.
So, in New York, before you moved to Pennsylvania, which is, I'm assuming, sometime around...
I didn't move. I went to university there.
Oh, okay.
My family stayed there. I just sort of, you know, just continued wandering after I graduated.
Well, that sounds fun.
It was.
So, in New York, when you were growing up, what sports did you play?
Primarily tennis. My dad was a tennis player, and I was his partner from about age 4 onward. We would play at public courts under the George Washington Bridge, and I would go down with him on Saturday and Sunday mornings, and he would play with his partners, and then I was given some exercises to do, like hitting cans of tennis balls, you know, from the service line, and then after he finished, he would rally with me. As I grew older, in grade school, I was a softball player, never played hardball, and played tennis for my high school team, and I was the manager of the bowling team. Very exciting.
Well, bowling is supposedly the most popular sport in the United States. That's what I've read.
Oh, excellent.
I'm not sure what popular means exactly, but... So you had quite a bit of sport participation. What were some of your major influences in terms of sport participation or sports heroes at that time?
I think it was just the crowd that I grew up with. All of my friends were reasonably active. We all played games. We had a wonderful grade school, which had an active after school program. One part of the season it was basketball, another part of the season it was dodgeball, and then baseball season. So we were always doing something. And my father was, he was just really into his tennis. And I remember, as I got older in high school, we would play during the winter months at public courts, and if necessary, we would shovel snow or, bring brooms if it had rained. He was intrepid about that, rain or shine, we went out there and hit a tennis ball. So, and he did that until he was in his early 80s. So I would have to say my dad and my friends.
Wonderful. So he played until he was 80. That's amazing.
He did, and, not until the very end did he just seem unhappy with playing, but he was always, always out there and always trying to correct the backhand or always trying to correct something. He was always about ready to take a lesson. Never did. He was self-taught.
Oh.
He was determined to get better and better.
Did he teach you and encourage you to play tennis then?
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started to show minimal promise, he had me take lessons. I took lessons for about a year or two from a coach in New York City at the 145th Street Armory called Mike Ryland. And those were the days when in the winter you played on wood courts, indoor. The surface was wood. It was very fast. Great experience.
Wow, I don't think I've ever seen a game on a wooden court.
Well, they don't play it anymore because they have that stretch canvas or whatever it is they use. But before they had that, you played on wood, and there was a national indoor wood court championship. So no more, but it was a very fast game. It was like playing on a basketball court, and so the ball really skidded off. It was great fun.
So when did you first hear about what eventually became your Olympic sport?
This is a story that my wife, whenever she hears anybody ask me, how did you get started, she sort of rolls her eyes and excuses herself and heads for the bar. I spent my freshman year, I was at New York University. And in those days, you had to take a freshman had to take a physical education class, PE. And the university was in Washington Square, and having to get sweaty during the middle of the day was absolutely no fun, but you had to do it. The other thing is that NYU did not offer freshman tennis teams. They had a varsity team, and again, in those days, they had freshman teams and separate from the varsity team. And so I wanted to at least do something that helped keep my legs in shape over there. And the options for this PE class were limited, given the fact that this was Washington Square, Greenwich Village, New York. They didn't have athletic facilities, so you could either go bowling or table tennis or fencing. And I said, well, fencing, why not? You know, that'll keep my legs in shape. And so I, you know, was in the fencing class. Unbeknownst to me, NYU was a national fencing power. They'd been NCAA champion for a number of years, all runners-up. At any rate, I'm in this class, and somewhere around prior to Thanksgiving, after midterm exams, it turned out that a few of the fellows who had been, recruited for the NYU freshman fencing team didn't pass their academic grades, and so they were ineligible for the season. And again, unbeknownst to me, the fellow that was teaching our class, the freshman PE class, was the freshman coach. And so he came in and he said, hey, you, would you be interested in playing on the freshman team to replace the guys that were ineligible? And I was one of them, and I said, sure. I said, however, the deal has got to be that I get out of the midday PE class and get credit for, you know, being on the team and doing practice. And that was the arrangement he was agreeable to. And that's how I got started. And to be honest, I did okay. Not brilliant, I don't think. And then in my sophomore year, I transferred down to the University of Pennsylvania. And I was down there for freshman orientation, although I was a sophomore, but tennis was my sport. So I'm playing tennis out on the tennis courts at U of P, and I could hit the ball pretty well, and the varsity tennis coach happened to walk by and saw me playing and introduced himself and, you know, asked me who I was, and I explained my situation. And on the Ivy League, if you're a transfer student in, you lose a year of athletic eligibility. He said, well, you know, you might be able to make the team in your junior year. Why don't you, join the varsity and, you know, practice? At least you get the court time, because we didn't have many courts at Penn in those days. So I said, great, fine. That was wonderful. So I started playing tennis, and, you know, as school started, I was playing, you know, at the afternoons, and lo and behold, the fencing coach walks by one day and he recognizes me from the Penn NYU freshman match. He said, weren't you at Penn, at NYU last year? And I said, yes. And, you know, introduced myself. And he said, well, look, he said, you can't play tennis all winter long here. Why don't you come join the fencing team, you know, in the wintertime? And at least you could, you know, who knows? So I joined the Penn varsity team. And in my junior year, I played tennis. Not brilliantly. I think I was the next to last man, if not the last man on the squad, played only doubles, and I fenced, and I was okay. I did well. I think I was All-American that year. And then in my senior year, I was asked to be captain of the fencing team, and the tennis coach and I had this long conversation, and I regretfully had to resign, although there was no chance that I could make the tennis team at Penn. They had a great crop of players come in. And I fenced again my senior year, and I think I was runner-up NCAA champion or something like that. And we had a decent season. And I just, if you want to hear the rest of the story, it gets worse.
I do.
So I had decided to do some postgraduate research work in England. And I also happened to have had a summer job in a small merchant bank in London. So I knew I was going to spend the summer up in London, and I was doing my graduate research down at the University of Southampton. And, of course, I was, again, primarily in my mind, a tennis player, not a fencer. And I never even knew that there was life outside of college and fencing. I just never computed, never followed it. I get to London, and my coach at Penn, Lajos Csar, Hungarian, had escaped in 1956 along with his best friend, who was a coach in London. And so my coach at Penn, Lajos, gave me a letter written in Hungarian if I ever decided to go visit his friend to give him this letter. So a couple of weeks into there, I'm a bit lonely in London, don't know too many people, and I've got my fencing bag because the university had given me all my kit as a sort of a going-away present, and it was a wonderful bag to carry tennis rackets in, and I had three of them. So I also had my fencing stuff with me, and I one night went along to this club, handed him the letter, and I hadn't fenced now since, I guess, Easter, so, you know, it's towards the end of March, April, when we had the NCAAs.
And what year?
Now,
what year is this?
This would have been 1965.
Okay.
This was the summer of 1965. I'm in London. And he looks at the letter, and he said, no, you know, Lajos speaks highly of you, blah, blah, blah. And it just turned out that night that the British team that was going to represent Britain at the World University Games in Budapest were training at the facility that this coach was at. So he introduced me to some of the fellows, and they invited me to join them, and I fenced around, and I had now fenced for about 3 months, I guess. As I say, this is about July. We finished in March, April. After, you know, an hour or two, he calls me over, and he asked me, you know, how I did, and I said, okay. He said, what did you think about the British team? I said, wow, they're okay, but, you know, I haven't fenced for a long time, and I would have thought they would have sort of eaten my lunch, and they didn't. He said, well, get on guard. So he asked me to do a few things, and I hadn't a clue what he was talking about, simply because I was just trained in a very simple way, and he was mystified that I didn't understand what I now know was like taking baby steps. I mean, I could crawl, but I couldn't do the baby steps, and he said, come back tomorrow night. So I came back the next night, and he gave me another sort of lesson. And he said, you know, you ought to go to the World University Games like the British team, you know, the track. And I said, wow, can I get a sweatshirt? You would say. He said, well, I don't know about that. So the long and short of it is that I wrote to the American, I can't remember who was organizing, I don't think it was the USOC, and I got myself into the World University Games in 1965. And what you need to know is that the United States was convinced that the World University Games was some kind of a communist plot because it was run by I can't remember what the foundation name was. They were based at the time in Warsaw, Poland. And of course, in 1965, that was behind the Iron Curtain.
Mm-hmm.
But 1965, they were for the first time going to send a demonstration team. So there was a basketball team, there was a small swimming team. Well, I think there was a full swimming team, a few people in track and field. And since I was in London and willing to and able to pay my own way to get there, they said that, sure, you know, you could fence. So I was the lone American. I roomed with some of the basketball players. The Van Arsdale brothers were on that team. Lou Hudson was on that team. It was a fabulous team, basketball team. And I fenced. I was eliminated in the first round. Fencing is done on a pool system. If for argument's sake you have 60 competitors, they divide up the field into 10 groups of six each. you fence round robin, so you have five matches, and then they take usually they take the top two or the top three, and you get promoted. Everybody else is out. And I fenced in the first round and got eliminated, and you know, packed my bags and went home. Mm. And when I got back to London, my fencing master had said to me, you know, please bring back your score sheet so I could see how you did against whoever you fenced. So I brought back my score sheet, and I had two victories and three defeats. I lost to the three people that were promoted up, and I was very disappointed because I was, you know, reasonably close with two of those defeats. We were 4-4, and it could have gone either way. Five touches being the what you have to score. Mm-hmm. And he goes through the list with me, and he says, "Wow." He said, you were 4-4 with this guy, Losert, who had been at 18, he was world champion in Epe, which is my event. And the other guy I lost to was the Swedish national champion. And the third guy was a Russian who, I don't remember where he was, but he was very good. And I beat the two other people that were, you know, in the group. He said, you know, for somebody who doesn't ever fence internationally, that's reasonable scores. And he said to me, how much time do you have in England? And then I only had, my horizon was 2 years. It ultimately became three. He said, if you could give me 3 days a week training, I'll get you onto the 1968 Olympic team.
Oh, wow.
Well, you know, athletes are carrot chasers. And I said, that's an interesting idea. So that's how I started. And I trained with him for many, many years.
Hmm.
Bela Imregi was his name.
Can you say that one more time?
Bela, B-E-L-A, Imregi, I-M-R-E-G-Y.
Thank you so much. So you were living and working in England prior to the games, or when did you come back to the States?
Well, no, I was. I was a grad student from 1965 right until... you know, I returned back after in the summer to qualify for the U.S. team, and then I didn't go back to London for many years later. But I was there for 3 years.
And were you an economics grad student or?
I was doing it was postgraduate research in economics.
Was this at the London School of Economics?
No, although partially it was. I was technically at the University of Southampton. Mm. What happened was that I was part of a group of grad students that had been assembled by the head of the economics department there, David Rowan, to assist with a project he was working on. And we were his research assistants, like being in a lab. And we were going to, you know, if we completed everything, we would all get what was known as an MPhil. In other words, a master's by philosophy, because you're doing, it's not by examination, it's by doing the research and writing papers and all that. After David met with, there were seven of us on his team, he had a massive heart attack the next day, and the university didn't know what to do with us because we were his team. Nobody else knew what to do with us. So we all ended up at the LSE for that year as readers and just continuing, you know, to study in the field, which was, it was monetary economics and its impact on development. When he came back in year two, the project that he was on, because he had lost a whole year, sort of disbanded it, and he and I just continued to do some work in his field, and that's what I did for the next, and then I was able to stay for one more year to assist him, and that was the end of it.
Mm. So, you went back to the States for the Olympic trials in the summer of 1968?
Yes, at the time, and I'm not sure what the arrangements are now, but you had to accumulate points in various competitions. So I came back a couple of times. We spread out over 2 years, points from the, for example, the 67 Nationals. At one point they were worth 100%. By 1968, they were worth maybe 50%. So I think there were about four tournaments or five tournaments that you could accumulate points toward qualifying for the Olympic team. So I would come back periodically to compete in those events.
Oh, okay. So So when were you in Moscow? It was that 1966?
I've got the poster upstairs in my bedroom. I think it is 66. It was the World Championships of, yeah, it would have been. It was the first time I even knew about them. In 1966, yes.
Okay. And so did you go from London to Moscow for the World Championships?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And then, so how was that? What was Moscow like then in 66?
It was very odd. You know, athletes, it's like you live in a sort of a cocoon because you don't have an awful lot of time to go wandering around, and you're sort of under a general organization. You know, you're there for the competition, so you've got X numbers of days prior to your event that you train. Maybe you have an hour or two afterwards, and if you're not too tired, you might go wandering around, and then, you know, there's team dinner and blah, blah, and then you've got the competition, and then you're finished and you go home. So you don't have too much spare time, at least outside of your hotel. And so it's hard to give you an overall impression of Moscow, except for the fact that what I thought was, to me, just a very memorable story. The dining facilities at the hotel were not divided, but in the room where there were huge tables of, like, that held 10. And each country had a flag on it, so the French ate at their table and the Italians ate at their table, et cetera. And I was I was at the American table. But I came over from London with the fellows from the British team because they were on a charter and it was just cheaper to join them. And it just happened that I got to Moscow about a day or two earlier than the rest of the team. So I was sitting at this table all by myself, you know, table for 10 or what have you. And I'm sitting there, you know, and I knew a lot of the people, but that's where they had me sit. And a fellow comes up and sits down and says, "You must be Stephen." And I said, "Yes." He said, "Welcome to Moscow." I said, "Oh, thank you very much." And, we're having a nice conversation. He's wearing a short sleeve shirt, you know, he's got a tie on, like a rep tie, red and blue, and we're having this great conversation. And I'm saying, "God damn!" I mean, I didn't know the team really very well because I hadn't been back to the States yet, and I'd never been in sort of national level fencing, so I didn't know who was on the team or even what they looked like. And I'm just sort of trying to figure out who is this guy. Finally, he starts with me. I said, "I apologize, but I did ask your name, and I don't know you." And he said, "Oh, my name is Vladimir, blah blah blah." And I said, "Vladimir?" He said, "Yes, I'm your interpreter for the..." His English was absolutely Midwest America.
Oh.
He looked Midwest. And so I commented on it. And he told me that he went to language school, and they had, in the language school in the Soviet Union then, they could give you a Boston accent, a Texas accent, a Midwest accent. And so he just decided that he liked the Midwest. And so he picked the Midwest, and that was his accent. And anyway, so Vladimir was our guy. The rest of the team shows up, and we have a lot of time. We have a lot of fun. They're very nice people. A lot of my roommates were terrific. And we're sitting one day in one of the people's room. I can't remember. And we're just sort of yakking and talking. And somebody looks out the window, and our hotel backed onto railroad tracks. And they had looked out the window, and it was, I don't know, 10 o'clock at night, 11 o'clock at night. And they see that there's this freight train going by with just all sorts of tanks on it, all covered up in canvas or whatever. But you can see that tank, it's a military transport freight train. Mm-hmm. And everybody goes to the window and starts taking photographs and all this. And Vladimir, who's with us, because he'd become a good buddy, he said, "You guys, you can't do that. I told you, no photographs of trains, no photographs of crossings or airports." You know, he'd sort of told us the do's and don'ts. And he said, "Besides, this is a terrible place to take these photographs. Tomorrow, we'll go downstairs. I'll show you where you get the shots. But please, don't do this." And he was just a terrific guy. So we had a very, very nice time.
How fun.
Yeah, it was.
So we're going to skip ahead from Moscow in 66, going back to the United States in 68 for the trials. Can you tell me about the trials?
Well, I was a pretty confident fencer by now. You know, it's in those days, and it's certainly not true anymore. I used to say that American fencing is to European fencing as European basketball was to American basketball. By that I mean our basketball players, just it's instinctual. A give and go, they don't even think about it. In Europe, it's, you know, give and a go. It just took time. Now, the world has changed, but in 1968, that was true. And it was true of our fencing. We had very little international exposure. Our fencers simply couldn't regularly train and or compete in Europe. As I said, that when I was starting out, you know, you every 4 years you went to the Olympics. You had the Pan Am Games. You had the World Championships. We didn't field the best team. We fielded people because the sport couldn't afford to, didn't have the funds to send a team. If you said that you could pay your way, you could go to the World Championships and represent the United States. So we had, you know, competent but certainly not international class fencers who went to the World Championships. And that's simply because Europe was the home of you know, top level fencing, just like America was the home of top level basketball. I had the benefit of being able to train and compete in Europe, so I got to develop a game that was in tune with what was going on currently. Most of the Americans had very little exposure to that style of fencing. So I had a lot of confidence going in, and I had also had a lot of points going in, so I was reasonably certain that as long as I made the finals, and I don't hold me to this, but I think the finals were a group of eight, I could make the team. And indeed, I made the finals, and I believe I ended up third. And I remember writing to my my then girlfriend, an American who I'd met in London and who I've subsequently married, I sent her a telegram saying, took third, training begins again. And she was just baffled by what that meant. She didn't know whether or not that meant I didn't earn enough points and therefore I had to go back to square one or what have you. So we had this long conversation on the phone to figure that all out. And I will also tell you that, and I don't know if this is true of other people who have made teams, after I made the team, it was very depressing. And the only, looking back on it, the only explanation is that for X numbers of years, you train with an objective in mind, make the Olympic team, you know, whatever it is, the World Championship team, and you train and you train and you work towards that day and you put everything into it, and then athletes do that, as you know. Mm-hmm. And then the day comes, and it happens, and you make the team. And then you look back, you say, wait a minute, now what? Mm-hmm. I mean, that goal, to an extent, for a couple of days, it's kind of like, wow, the only thing I've thought about for, you know, 3 years has happened, and I don't feel any different. And you know what? Tomorrow morning, I got to go back and run, you know, two more miles, and I got to start, you know, I've got to do the same thing. And you want to believe that something's different. At least it was true in my case. Mm-hmm. And so it took a couple of days, and I really wanted to just go off and not train and not do anything and just sort of absorb whatever it was I needed to absorb. And finally, you know, you get over that, you say, hey, you got to get your act together here because you're going to be facing all the guys again. So you go back to training. But that was my experience after having made the team.
That's very interesting. I've had that feeling myself before with, you know, after, you know, earning my master's and graduating, that same kind of feeling.
Right. You know, it's like, oh, yeah?
So can you tell me a little bit about the reaction of your friends and family to your making the team?
My family was, closest, of course. By now, a lot of my friends had, you know, everybody had started their lives, and some of them were in the Peace Corps, and some of them had married and moved on. You know, everybody was very pleased. I'm not, that part of my life is, I've always sort of kept kind of just quiet. It's a very personal thing. I mean, I'm not into talking a lot about my athletics, and so I you know, was, if you were somebody on you know, in my fencing world, fine, you all, everybody knew about it, and the guys at the club, you know, and coaches, everybody would congratulate me, but I didn't make a big deal of it. I think my folks cracked open a bottle of champagne, and we went on about our business. It's the way I would have liked it.
Yeah.
And did like it. Yeah, you put a lot of effort in, and you know, people don't realize how much sacrifice everybody around you makes, and you yourself, and you sort of take these things quiet. At least I like to think you take them quietly.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was the impact of your training and your, you know, spending so much time and effort on your athleticism? What was the impact of that on your relationships with people?
I don't think that they, that was a there was much of an impact. My schedule, you know, everybody pretty much knew that in the evenings I would be gone 3 or 4 nights of the week, you know, until 10 o'clock at night, because I was training, so you know, my availability, that's you know, when people said, let's go to a film or something, they knew not to ask me because they knew that I was off training. And when they knew which nights I tended to be available, it's a good question. I'd like to ask other people, find out what they thought. I don't think most people, you know, bothered one way or the other. Mm-hmm. By 1968, the woman who became my wife, we were living together, so she... And she knew my schedule from, you know, as of 66, so that was just part of the routine.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, as long as you don't make too much of these things, you just sort of go about your business.
Mm-hmm. Were most of your friends also involved in athletics in some way, or did you have friends from...
No. I mean, certainly I had, you know, the fellas on the team, but I was fortunate in having a group of people outside that world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they knew of it, but it's, you know, it didn't. I mean, my wife worked in theatrical costumes, and that crowd was too flamboyant to care about athletics. So it was they were always fun.
Yeah, sounds like a fun time. So what was your training regimen after you made the team? Can you describe some of the training regimen and the exercises that you did to prepare for the games?
Well, I'll tell you, this wasn't a training regimen. This was a sleep regimen. after I made the team, I called my coach, Imre Gee, in London. And I told him that I made the team, and you know, we had a long chat. And he knew I wasn't going to be able to come back between then and the games. And he said to me, I don't want you to drink any more beer or any wine, no alcohol from now on. So this is like maybe early July of 68. And he said, and the night before your event, I want you to get into bed and have a can of beer next to you and drink as much of the can of beer as you can, and you'll sleep all night long and you'll wake up fine. This was so staggering, I can't tell you. The reason being that in London for 3 years, our standard every single night procedure was whoever was at the club, we would all train for close to 3 hours. We would shower up, and we all headed to the pub, and we all drank at least 3 pints of beer. That was, you know, there we go. Every time we trained. So for him to say that to me was so out of place, I couldn't figure it out. But you know what? Athletes are, as I said, we listen to the coaches, and whatever the coach says, you do it, or you change coaches. So this is what he said. we trained, I was in New York, and the New York Athletic Club made its facilities available to all of us. And this, again, this is the summer. They had no air conditioning. We trained as we normally did. There was nothing, I didn't have to add any more to what I already was doing. I mean, I had a pretty full plate. Fortunately, I had the summer to myself, unlike some of the others who were working. So I was able to do everything I want. And every night it was, you know, hotter than the hammers of hell in the fencing room. And the AC was very, very accommodating. It opened up their, made their bar facility available to everybody who was training. And, you know, the guys would have pitchers of beer and whatever. And Steve Netburn would order an orange juice and soda water night after night. Finally, I get to the Olympic Games, and it's the night. I don't know if you may have talked to the others, but the accommodations were pretty sparse. We had, they were, I think all of the men's team, there were, what, close to 20 of us, in what was an apartment, and there were bunk beds, and it was hot, noisy, and everybody was nervous, and guys who were competing the next day would barely get any sleep in. They'd be up, they'd be down, they'd go to the bathroom, what have you. We also, each of us had, the day before your event, you were assigned somebody who already competed or somebody who was not going to be in the individuals. They were your, quote, your second. And so the day before, they would sort of be your buddy. They would go to weapons check with you to make sure all your gear was okay. And if there was any problems, they'd run around. And if you wanted this or you needed to sew that, they were just there. And George Mason, one of my teammates, was my second. And so we, you know, sort of palled around all day long. We got all the bits and pieces done. And we go to have our meal. And I say, George, I'm going to turn in early, if you don't mind. But I have to do one errand. And he says, well, I'll come with you. I said, nah, George, I got to walk outside the village and buy something. One of the guys, you know, the street vendors are out there. He said, no, I got nothing to do. You know, I'll go walk with you. I said, okay. So we go out there, and I see a street vendor, and he's got a cans of Tecate beer on his little thing. And I said, I'll take a can of beer. And George, who'd been training, you know, with us all summer, he looks at me, he says, you're having beer now? I mean, he'd seen me have orange juice. So George, I said, this is too long a story to explain. I just need a can of beer. He's baffled. I get into bed. I crack open this can of beer. My recollection is that I drank a quarter of it, maybe less, maybe more. The next thing I knew, they were shaking me to wake up.
Oh, wow.
And years, I've told this story many times, and I am convinced that what actually happened to me wasn't the fact that the alcohol just sort of put me to sleep, is that I was hypnotized by my coach in London. I really do believe that. I believe that every night that we sat down and everybody ordered beer or whatever, and Steve Netburn had to order an orange juice, I was reinforcing the idea that I'm not drinking now, I will drink at a certain point, and I will sleep at that point. And every single night I reinforced that idea, and it did exactly what it was supposed to do.
Smart coach.
And I think that's a sign of fabulous coaching.
Yeah.
You know.
Absolutely.
Anyway.
He understood the psychology very well.
I there's nothing like good. Where you see good athletes, you see good coaches.
Mm. So you reminded me of another question, Steve, while you were talking. But how was your training and supported? You said a lot of the other guys were working. How are you able to support yourself at that time?
Through my years in London, my family supported me because I was doing postgraduate work. I actually, for a while, was a tour guide in London to earn a little bit of a living. Sort of a bizarre story. I passed myself off. I worked for an organization called Student Tours Unlimited. And my cover story, because I was American, was that I was born in England. This is all untrue. My parents are English, also untrue. But at the age of three, again untrue, my family moved to Toronto, where my dad had been reassigned to a company there, and grew up in Canada, untrue, and went to the University of Pennsylvania, where I graduated. True. And now I was back in the UK getting my doing economic research at the University of Southampton, which was true. Hence, here I am. And hence my accent being so American. This company's selling point was you're not going to get a tour guide who knows all the dates and histories. You got a lot of, you know, you got these were students. You got their point of view. They would take you around. They could give you most of the answers and what have you. And that's what we did. You had your own. We had our own. I had my own car, and you picked up your clients and you drove them around. And the fun thing for me was that I would do things like, you know, give them the slang, the English slang, and compare it to the American slang. So, for example, and again, in those days, you didn't. It wasn't the the decimalized pound. It was, you know, shillings and pence and what have you. And the coins had their own slang. So, for example, and this is still true, the slang for the pound was a quid. And I would say, you know, quid is to pound as buck is to dollar. And then there was a 10p piece, and I says, you know, a tanner, you know, is the equivalent of a nickel. And, you know, we'd go back and forth and have all these things. And we, so it was great fun for them, and it was great fun for me. And I can't tell you the number of business cards I got from men who said, if you ever come to America, look us up, you know? But mostly my financing came from my family.
Well, that's good that you had, you know, a means of support. A lot of athletes, you know, had to struggle with that. So
it's a big problem.
Yeah, definitely. That's a great story. I thank you for explaining what a quid was. That was always very confusing to me, pound and quid. So, altitude training. Did you guys do any high altitude preparation before the games?
No. You know, you made the team. You trained. The USOC cleverly had us a stage in Denver, and you know, I can't remember exactly how we all got to Denver. If there were, you know, because everybody was coming from all over the place, and I remember we had a couple of training sessions while we were in Denver. But unlike, I think the swimmers, I think we're at the Air Force Academy. Training mm-hmm. For a couple of weeks prior to help them with their acclimatization, but we didn't have that. I'm not, you know, fencing was and continues to be a relatively minor sport, more so then than now. We've now got some real international caliber people. Yeah. So we were pretty much on our own, and our own national organization was not really geared up to top level, you know, international competition. I mean, just as an example, after my first year, I think in Europe and on the, you know, competing in many of the major competitions, one of the German guys said to me, "Oh, you're coming to Heidenheim, which is one of the biggest tournaments in the EPE world." And I said, "Yeah, you know, I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to afford to come because I'm going to go here, there." He said, "Well, you know, just tell your federation to get in touch with the German federation because, you know, they supply airfare. You know, if you're in the top, you know, whatever." And I was by then. He said, "You'll definitely get, you know, part of your way, and they have, you know, housing that they have arrangements and all that." There was no direct money to me, so I got in touch with our president. I said, "By the way, you know, here's the story, and here's the people to speak to." He said, "Oh, no, you can't do that." He said, "It violates the amateur status." I said, "All I'm telling you is that everybody, you know, in Europe, all the major tournaments do the same thing. They reimburse or they provide you with, you know, something." And he said, "Well, I'll have to look into this." And he was a lawyer. And finally, you know, he figured out that, yes, you could do all that. This was permissible. You know, but we had never done that. We didn't swim in that water. We were not part of that scene because in America, the sport was such a minor thing. Whereas in Europe, it was a very much different thing. Mm-hmm. So going back to altitude training, organizing that would have been beyond their capability.
I see.
But we did okay. What? I mean, that wasn't, people acclimated pretty fast. I mean, if you had a, We got to Mexico City almost a week before the game started, and you had, 4 or 5 days in Denver. No, that was enough. I mean, I never felt any problems.
Oh, okay. Were any of your teammates or was your coach concerned about the high altitude of Mexico City?
Some of them were. We had a foilist named Uriah Jones, and Uriah, I don't know if there's any scientific basis for this, told me that after he, at his club, it was at a big facility, and they had a sauna, and he said that after he trained, he went into the sauna and did, 200 sit-ups and a whole batch of other exercises in the heat, because that was going to help him with the acclimatization. I don't know if that was true or not, but no. I mean, people may have voiced it, but we didn't seem to bother anybody.
Huh. Well, that's good. So, did you, while you were training and preparing for the games before you went to Mexico City, did you ever receive a letter from the Harvard crew team about the Olympic Project for Human Rights?
No.
Do you remember hearing anything about the Olympic Project for Human Rights or boycotting the Olympics or the...
To be honest, no. And I have Tom Lowe, who keeps the 68 team pretty well organized, has sent me lots of things, and one of them was the book that was written. I can't remember if it was it Smith or Carlos, somebody wrote a book about the 68 team. And I was just fascinated about the things I didn't know about the team. I must be honest.
Okay, that's interesting. So, what about the Tlatelolco massacre, the massacre that occurred in Mexico City? Do you remember hearing about?
Yes, absolutely. And I know that there was just a lot of concern about how the Mexican government were treating its students, and we knew all about, I believe the university had been closed before we got there, but I mean within our group, and at the Olympics, and maybe this is not true for other sports, but you tend to sort of stay within your sport. I don't know the guys on the swimming team. We don't have too much crossover during the course of the year. So the people that you pal around with and talk about with tend to be within your own sport or the people that you have trained with from other countries. I mean, I knew the entire British team. They were, they were becoming my lifelong friends, and they have remained that. I knew guys on the French team and the Russian team and the Hungarian team. Run into them and you chit-chat. But you wouldn't have much to do with guys and women in the on the American team and in other sports. So the conversations were pretty much contained for me within the fencing team. And my recollection was that, we were amazed that this was going on, but I don't recall any discussion about any kinds of boycotts or any sort of actions that were going to be taken.
Mm-hmm. When you arrived in Mexico City, what were your impressions of the city, and what are some things that particularly stand out that you saw upon first arriving there?
Well, one of the things that we saw was that they had put up big fences, and so that you couldn't see into the slum areas on the routes that the buses were taking to the Olympic Village. Every team was assigned a local person to be their interpreter. Just like we had Vladimir in Moscow, we had this young lady from Mexico City who was with us, and her family lived with her family, and they were enormously kind to the fencing team, and in fact had a big reception for us at their home. And I will tell you that it was one of the more spectacular homes I have ever seen in my life. And you really got a sense of the incredible dichotomy between the wealthy and everybody else. we subsequently got invited because of that. Somebody else was going to hold another thing, and we were invited, and we knew a lot of the fellas on the Mexican team, so we were all there. And, you know, you began to appreciate that there was, you know, the haves and the have-nots. Having said that, again, you don't wander around too much if you're focused on competing. So, you know, it's not like you take a half a day off to go to the museum. You know, it's just, it's, you know, it's, you're there for something else. But everybody that we met was incredibly helpful and friendly. I will say that you could see that there was a serious problem on the bus ride in from to the opening ceremony. And maybe it was a 20-minute bus ride, or half hour, maybe less, from where the village was. On the bus and inside the bus were two military guys, and there was a guy sitting on the rooftop, and on the road, lining the road on either side, were Army people with rifles, two deep, spaced maybe 10 feet apart from each other. That's a lot of people. And I remember one of the guys on the team, my recollection was that it was John Carlos, but I could be dead wrong and he'll correct me. Hello?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh. Said as we were sort of lining up and we'd seen all this military, there were lots of helicopters, he said he hears the shot and the races to the airport. And I remember we all thought that was pretty funny coming from a track and field guy. But it was, you know, that was the sad part about it. But it was, you know, they kept it away from us, so we never got to really see that.
Interesting. So
other people say other things?
No, there's pretty much the same thing. Very few people, you know, got to venture out a whole lot or, you know, see a whole lot there. I've heard some people say stuff about the security, how it was nothing like it was, you know, in 72 or after 72, of course. But
correct, absolutely.
But they remember seeing, like policemen or security guards with big guns, and they thought that was kind of unusual.
Well, yes, you're right. I mean, 72, of course, changed the whole world, mm-hmm. in that sense. And 68, really, it began to change. That was the forerunner of what was to come. Only in the sense of demonstrations, the requirement for big security. The village was very open, but it's. It was a forerunner of what was to come, unfortunately.
So what was the food like there in the village? And did you or anyone you know get sick?
Well, you know, I recall they had us taking all these huge pills to prevent us from getting ill. And I don't remember. I guess some people got ill a little bit. Because a lot of that bacteria is, you know, airborne, so it doesn't make any difference what you're eating. I think I have a cast iron stomach. I could just about go anywhere and eat street food. I've always been a street food eater, much to the chagrin of my friends. The food was terrific.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing is, I haven't been to an Olympic village since the 72 games, but the 68 Olympics maintained a pattern, which I believe was finally changed in 72, which was that they would have, for argument's sake, five dining rooms, big setups, you know, with cafeteria and everything, and teams would be assigned to each dining room. So dining room one would have, for example, the whole Soviet group. You know, Russians and the Bulgarians and the Poles and Hungarians, whatever. And then in another group, they would have the African nations. And in another group, they would have all the English-speaking countries and, you know, and the Francophiles, what have you. And which was a drag because you had a coupon that you had or your ID which entitled you to eat only in your dining room.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had friends on other teams, and everybody who competes internationally got to know people on other teams, you know, because they're just, you know, just human beings. And a lot of them, a lot of fun. And you couldn't have lunch or breakfast or dinner with them unless you found somebody who was willing to swap your coupon to whatever you had. So it was a pain in the neck. And it was the Germans, to their great credit, changed that system. Yes, they had five dining rooms, but you know what? When dining room one got full, they opened up dining room two, and then dining room three. Anybody could sit anywhere they wanted, which is was a tremendous change. I know you didn't ask that question, but I just want to credit the Germans there.
No, that's exactly the kind of information that we're trying to get at. That's wonderful. One funny story that another Olympian told me was that the French dining room or area was the only one that had alcohol, so they would sneak in there to get wine.
It's true. I will tell you, after many years after I finished my Olympic things, I ended up becoming a producer of TV commercials and sort of did a fair amount of work in the film world and had done some work for a French company who had a shoot in Los Angeles and got very friendly with the guys who were putting that together. And my wife and I were on our way to, we're going to be spending some time with a friend of mine in Provence. And he said, we're shooting this project. We're going to be in a village not too far from you. Why don't you come and join us for lunch? So I said, fabulous. So we go down there, and we see the shooting and everything, and we're chatting with everybody, the two or three people that we really knew. And, they break for lunch, and they have the same kind of film, 8-foot-long table all set up just like every other film set you've ever seen for the crew. Place settings or what have you. And on every single table was a bottle of white wine and a bottle of red wine. Never in a million years could you put alcohol on a crew table in the middle of a shooting day. When I mentioned this to them, he said, Stephen, if we didn't have the wine, they would revolt. They would walk out. So, it's like it's just a different world.
Yeah, that's a great story. So what are your recollections from the opening ceremony?
The best recollection I have of opening ceremony is actually two stories. I'll tell you the less funny one first. And that is, we're standing there milling around, and, they organize you by height. And I'm 6'3"-ish. So I'm standing there, talking with whoever's around me, and I end up talking to a guy who turns out to be a marksman. And I'm going to assume the story is true. Please, I hope it is, because I've told it a million times. And I asked him, I said, how do you train? I said, what do you do? Shoot off 1,000 rounds every day or something? Just, keep your eye. How do you train as a marksman? He looked at me as if I was crazy. He said, no, we run. I said, you run? He said, yes. I said, well, why do you run? Figuring, fine. He runs a mile. He says, oh, 6-7 miles a day, every time. And we do it about, five or six times a week. I said, what? I said, look, I understand you need to have your legs nice and solid and steady. And, it's a long shooting day. I had no idea how long they shoot for. He looks at me again quizzically. He says, no, it's nothing to do with that. I said, then why do you train like a marathoner? He says, because we need to get our heart rate down to about, 60-ish, somewhere down in that area, maybe lower if we can, if we can get it lower. I said, why? He said, because we have to fire in between the heartbeats. That's when our body's at the most still.
Mm-hmm.
I said, what? He said, that's what we do. Anyway, that's one story. Who knew they did that?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Number two was, but the funny part is that, so I'm standing there, and all this is going on. And we get to that moment where they say, let the games begin. And as that happens, four or five people around me all of a sudden reach into their inside pockets and pull out a section of a newspaper. And they put it over their heads like the hats. And, of course, at the same time, they release thousands of these doves. And I said, what? He said, Stephen, if you've ever done this before, these birds have been cooped up for a long time. They have to take a crap. So, and you know what? When in 72, I carried a piece of newspaper.
Well, what happened in 68?
They didn't get me.
Okay.
Sarah, the guys, people who had been to previous games knew this, and so they just took out paper.
That's funny.
Yeah, it was pretty exciting walking in. You know, you dream about that and you work towards it, and it was a very impressive ceremony.
Mm. So, when was your event held, and where was it held, and can you describe what you thought of the facility?
I can't tell you where it was held. I don't know what the venue was. My only recollection was that in fencing, you get these pools, you know, six fencers, and you fence around. And in 1968, I was, somewhere in the, I guess I was ranked worldwide somewhere, 25 to 35, 40, somewhere in there. You know, I was okay. I was not brilliant, but I was, I had my days. And so the expectation was that I would, do reasonably well, having trained for 3 years with all these people. And in fact, I had gotten in trouble in this first round, and I had the toughest guy in my pool, who had already beaten everybody else, and he was my last bout. And I knew him, a Pole by the name of Nilaba, and he's a very tricky and awkward fencer. And I had to beat him to get myself out of this first round, or I was going home. And the captain of our team, chef de mission, who was the president of the federation and who had never been an international fencer, started giving me a lot of advice. And I said to Alan, his name was Alan Rubin, I said, Alan, you have to leave me alone. I know Nilaba very well. We fenced many times, and I got to really concentrate on this. And he walks away from me, Alan does, and about 30 seconds later, he walks right back. He says, you have a very bad attitude. I said, Alan, I apologize for that, but you haven't fenced Nilaba. You haven't been to Europe for the last 3 years. You don't have a clue what I need to do. I just need to really concentrate and focus on, thinking about this. Well, we got into this big things, and, I got into this sort of, you've got a bad reputation, a bad attitude. And I apologize, but I said, you've got to leave me alone now. And fortunately, I did beat Nilaba one of the few times that I've managed that. And that, to be honest, is really the most clear recollection I have of that day. I can't even tell you exactly where I ended up. What happens in fencing is you fence these pools and they keep eliminating, and then you get down to 64 fencers, or 32, depending upon how large the original pool is, the group is. And then you have a direct elimination. They rank you 1 to 32, so 32 is against 1, et cetera. If you lose in that round, that you go into a sort of a loser's pool and you compete on. And my recollection was that I won my first direct elimination, which got me into the round of 16. And then I lost in the round of 16. And I believe I lost in my first sort of loser's pool, which would have put me somewhere around 20th in the tournament. But I can't swear to that because I'd have absolutely no recollection anymore. I don't even know who I fenced.
So I looked up the results. There's a great website that is supposed to be very accurate because the person that that runs
you can correct me.
The person that runs it is well respected. But I looked it up and I don't understand fencing because I'm not a fencer, so I couldn't quite make out what it was trying to show me, but it has all of your rounds and your opponents and everything like that.
You have to send me this link so I could find it out.
Sure, definitely. I'll send you the link today. But
great.
When I was looking at it, I think you came out 13th in the end there.
Sorry?
13th.
Oh, you're right. Because I was 13th at the games, and I think I was ranked that year 19th in the world.
Okay.
That's where the round 20 comes in from.
Okay.
Yeah, that was...
So.
Oh, good. I'd love to see who I competed against.
Yeah, I can definitely send that to you.
Oh, please, thank you. That'd be great.
Mm-hmm. So, what did you do immediately after your event when it was over?
Well, I had a job. I was a school teacher in 19. I'd already gotten a job, so I got home and started work, and continued training. A little bit more difficult now, working and training. My intention was to, you know, stay nationally and internationally competitive. My future wife and I got our first apartment together in Brooklyn, and I continued training. It was a little bit odd. As I say, I now had a day job, and I remember that I would, you know, in order to get in, you know, the running that I believed I needed to do, I would get up, you know, at 6 o'clock in the morning and, you know, run for the 40 odd minutes that I needed to run for, and then, you know, go off to work. After my teaching year, I ended up working at a bank for a while. And that was a little easier schedule because I didn't have to do so much homework when I was teaching. I had to work virtually every night to get lesson plans because I was never trained as a proper teacher.
Hmm.
And then, you know, going to the club, and often my wife would drive in from Brooklyn and pick me up at the AC. I was now a member of the AC. And I tried to keep my schedule, you know, to get the hours that you needed to do in. We married in 1970. We had our first child in 72. You know, you do the best you can.
Right.
You sneak it in. I remember we had gone down to Philadelphia to visit her family, aunts and uncles down in the Philadelphia area. And, you know, it was a weekend, and the weekends were really the only time I could really go out for any kind of a long run. And I just, you know, got out of bed at 6 and went out and ran in the, you know, wherever you were, if you're going to stay competitive, you got to put in the hours.
Right.
There's no way around it. And it was tough.
So going,
but you did it.
Going back to 68 though, did you stay in Mexico City after your event, and did you, you know, see any of the other events, or did you go home immediately afterwards?
No, you know, we're now you Epe is one of the last events. It happens in the second week of the Olympics, at least then it did.
Uh-huh.
So as soon as your events were, and then there's the team event, so you've got a couple of days that you're competing, and so you didn't have an awful lot of time. But we would go to, you know, various events. I went to track and field. I was there when Bob Beamon, you know, launched that incredible leap. I'm trying to remember some of the other sports we went to. Went to diving one day, I remember. But after the games, you know, we were on charter flights, so I had no other choice but to, you know, go back with the team.
Right. Did you have any interactions with any athletes from the Soviet bloc, and did you notice any, you know, effects on interactions between teams, effects of the Cold War?
Well, I knew those guys. I mean, I trained with them, and competed with them. I knew, you know, almost everybody on that team. They helped me get black market rates when I went to Moscow. A thing I was finally explained to by a British guy, a fellow on the British team, who said, don't ever do that. He said, you never know when the world championships are going to be held in X country, and if you violated one of those rules, then you're ineligible to go back to that country. He said, for what? You saved $50, $25? He said, Stephen, don't do that.
Ah.
So, but, you know, the Russian guys and I, we had been, this is sort of a sad story about me. We were at a big competition in Poitiers, held in France every year, and the two leading Russians, this guy Nikonchikov and Grigory Kris, and Kris was what? Well, Nikonchikov was world champion at least once or twice. Kris was silver medalist, I think, in Tokyo, and I think he was in the finals of 68, but he was one of the great guys. Anyway, we're all at this competition, and my girlfriend, now wife, had come down from London. This was, you know, in that 68 period, and we're at Poitiers, and after the competition, the town hosts a big dinner at the end for all the athletes that have come in. So we're sitting there, and Gilpin is sitting next to me, and two guys on the French team are next to her, and Grigory and Nikonchikov are sitting across, and we're all sort of nattering away. Kris spoke better English than Nikonchikov. At any rate, we're just sort of starting dinner, and all of a sudden, Nikonchikov pops up, and he's a big boy, and he has a glass of wine, and he turns to my wife, Gilpin, and girlfriend, and he says, "Gilpin, you know, to your health." And he drinks a toast to her and sits down. And Almond, with Frenchman, next to me, says, "Stephen, the custom is in Russia that if a man drinks a toast to your woman, you have to sort of rise and acknowledge it and drink a toast to her." So, oh, great. So I stand up. Gilpin, you know, thank you. Nikonchikov, I drink my glass of wine and sit down. At which point, Kris pops up, and he drinks a toast to Gilpin. And I figure, okay, great. So I stand up. Gilpin, Kris, thank you very much. I sit down. I drink my glass. 10 seconds later, Nikonchikov pops up. Another toast to Gilpin. I said, no. Two Russians, I can't even take on one. I said, you guys, pick some other sucker. I can't do this. So, yes, the answer is, you know, we knew these guys. I knew the Hungarian team. Several of their fencers had come over to the there was a big tournament at the New York AC every year, the Martini and Rossi. They would fly in. A lot of Hungarians in American fencing, my coaches here, both at the AC and at Penn, were Hungarians. And, you know, their attitude in general was that they live under a system that sucks. But it was a system that was supporting them for the moment. And they made the best of it. And you know, they had no real deep political concerns. They were athletes. They were just like me and everybody else, and they hated the system and they loved the system. And it was what it was. They weren't taking it on, and it was sad because a lot of them had difficult lives. I mean, if they weren't successful athletes, they were going to be in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I never had a single problem with any of them. I loved all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Try to beat them, but they were tough.
So, testing for banned and performance-enhancing substances, 68 was one of the first years in which they instituted drug testing. Did you or anyone you know have to submit to a test? And if so, how did you feel about that?
I recall giving a urine sample, but, you know, that was just part of the deal.
Yeah.
But, I mean... That was the beginning of a lot of talk about it, but, you know, fencing didn't really have, I mean, I'm trying to think of, you know, what we would take drugs for. I guess if to build muscles or, but, you know, fencing doesn't require big, heavy muscles. It needs those long things. You know, you need to be more explosive, maybe endurance. But I, you know, if there was a drug out there, I didn't know it. The strongest drug I took were aspirins.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll tell you a funny story about drugs, and this is, but it was legal. I'm on the plane from Denver to Mexico City. I happen to be just the way they set up the seats. I'm sitting next to a fellow who was a welterweight weightlifter. Maybe I've got the weight class wrong. Very nice guy. We're chatting. And they bring our lunch tray, and they put it down, and he reaches into his pocket and pulls out a little plastic bag and dumps the contents onto his tray. And there are about, my recollection is they were about 10, 12 pills different colors, different shapes, different sizes. And he starts taking one after the other, you know, and I'm looking at them, I'm saying, well, okay, you know, this is what he does. He finally gets down to the last pill, and it's a black pill. Now, I've never seen a black pill in my life. I haven't seen a lot of pills, but black is not a common color. So I said to him, I said, what is the black pill for? Not that I asked him about the other things. He said, oh, they helped me digest all the other pills. Yeah, I said, okay. And I asked, and you know, to your point, I asked him, I said, how did he expect to do in the games? And he sort of rattled off a couple of his opponents and what they had achieved, because, you know, in the weightlifting world, everybody knows that everybody's lifted. I said, well, he said, I said, do you think you have a chance? He says, yeah, I have a chance. He said, I just can't afford his pharmacologist.
Interesting.
But,
it was,
but you know, those were the days also of the argument about, you know, the Eastern Bloc country athletes were government supported, whereas our guys were supposedly purely amateur. And I had this debate with several people in the Eastern Bloc countries, and one of them said something that, you know, made me stop and think. He was in the army, in the Russian army, and that's how he was supported, and all he did was fence. And so I said, you know, you guys are pros. You know, my parents are laying out all the money here, and I pay all my own fees, and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And he nods his head and nods his head. He says, let me ask you a question about the American basketball team. I said, okay. He said, they all come from university. I said, yes, they all do. He said, do they pay for the university? I said, most of them have scholarships. I said, they get paid. He said, oh, okay, so they go to university for free. Do they have any expenses taken care of? Well, I happen to know from a prior team that a lot of them got, you know, room and board as part of the scholarship. So he said, so in your system, it's called university. In our system, it's called army. Tell me what the difference is, Stephen.
Yeah.
You know what? Not wrong.
Right, yeah, that's a really,
you know,
good.
So it's every system figures out its way to make it all work in those days. Now it's a different world, but you know, what was amateur was not entirely amateur.
Right.
Certainly,
right.
I mean, listen, I would say 99% of the, well, I don't know. I mean, our swimmers were all high schoolers anyway.
Yeah, it wasn't such a big college thing at that time.
No.
What about the women fencers? Did the men's team have you know, a lot of interactions with the women's fencers?
Oh yeah, we had. Interestingly, and I'm not sure why in those days, our women fencers were on several teams. As a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, in fact, I know I'm not. Jan Romery carried the Olympic flag, the American flag, when we walked in, because she was, I want to say a four-time, but she could have been a five-time Olympian.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so a lot of those girls were around for several years, and as a result of being on teams, you got to know them very well, you know, Jan and Harriet and I think some of the other lady. Oh, what was her name from San Francisco? I can't remember her name now. But that was part of the problem with the American team, was that we were an older team, and it just, again, it was just the difference between the, you know, the standard in America and the standard in Europe.
Hmm. So 68 was the first year, or maybe even the only year, where they actually instituted gender verification testing. Do you remember hearing anything about this?
Not really.
Mm. So the Smith and Carlos salute that took place on the medal stand, did you witness that, or were you around in the village when
I
that
did.
Happened?
I was there. I was in the stadium.
Oh, wow.
So I thought it was great.
So what?
And I didn't, and I just, you know, I didn't even know the backstory. I just thought that it was, listen, the United States then, and regrettably to some extent now, was a terribly racist country.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we applauded them, you know, people of color, you know, when they were performing for our entertainment. But in the real world, we had a different attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a great moment.
Yeah. So that was your reaction. Do you know what some of the reactions of the people around you were, and what did they say to you?
You know, I'd like to be very accurate here, so I have to say that I don't have a recollection of anybody saying anything. I think we all. My sense is that it was very political. I know there was a lot of disbelief that they were being sent home for that. I mean, it was. That was just a terrible mistake, but that was just a we were just a very naive country.
Yeah. So, the media, do you recall like a reaction from the media, or did you have any encounters with the media at that time?
No, I mean, we were two low profile athletes, I think, for the media to be interested in the fencers. I mean, there was a big thing. I mean, those were pretty explosive times in America and American civil rights. And I think that, you know, a lot of the media came down very heavily against them. But I, you know, like I said, I I never understood that opposition.
Yeah. What about any other memorable or interesting events or experiences that come to mind when you think of your time in Mexico City during the 68 games?
I think running into Don Scholander with all of his medals. He was wearing them. I mean, he has that famous photograph of the ball, very nice, but in the building, you know, they were just dangling. It was like it was a lot of gold. I don't know. I'm not sure this is entirely true, but I don't know if I should even say this. I'll say it anyway. There was Nike Puma and Adidas. Brothers who had split up, you know, they formed Adidas together, and then there was a row, and then one brother went off and formed German,
right.
A Puma.
Uh-huh.
And it was a big thing to get athletes to wear their shoes. And it was, they had set up, both of them had set up, I think off the perimeter of the village, a shop. And the story was that, you know, they had a pair of shoes for you. And then, you know, just show up, you know, give them your name, and they knew your size and everything because they'd got all of that. And if you were one of the big track stars, there was a $50 or $100 bill inside the shoes.
Oh.
So that was a story that was circulating. True or not, I really don't know. Because I never went, and I never got anything. And if they went, probably put in a nickel for me. Jeff Byrne, he gets a nickel, and not a penny more.
That's funny. So, were you there for the closing ceremony? And did
yep.
you? Okay.
Yep.
Can you tell me about
very,
that?
Very, very emotional.
Ah.
That was. I think that was more emotional than anything else, especially when they put up, Munich. It was a big chapter changing and. I think you kind of realize that I did for, you know, a big part of your life was now moving on. And, you know, you now had to face the next phase of what you were going to do and how you were going to focus. Because, as I say, anybody that ends up, you know, on an Olympic team or the Pan Am teams or world championship teams, any of those, you know, any big international thing, you go to represent, you know, your country, it's something. To make that team, you've devoted an awful lot of your time and your life to that, and you've made a lot of sacrifices that you're looking back, you might say, did I really, you know, I could have used my time better. And so when it's over and seeing Munich 72 flash, your focus for the last X numbers of years on Mexico City 68, you know, that's the end. It's a great moment to sort of look back and say, that was great. Now what? And so I think it was a very emotional for many of us.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly for me.
Definitely. It sounds like it would be. What one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful?
Go for it. You know, if you think you're good enough, just give it everything that you've got. You let the cards fall where they may. You know, some people get injured. Some people don't have the necessary skills. I said that, you know, you wonder whether or not it was worth the investment of time. I look back on my life, and so much of what has come after has been as a result of my experiences training and fencing and competing.
Mm-hmm.
Lifelong friendships. I've just had the chance to live in another country and to experience that country's attitude towards us and to me. And I've continued to think of Great Britain as my second home.
Mm.
You know? And I think that you only learn about yourself when you're competing. It's very lonely out there. You know, there's nobody else is going to wake you up in the morning to go out and do it. You learn a lot of life's lessons. You learn to, someone once said that the terrible thing is not in failing, it's in failing to get up. And you learn that as an athlete,
because
mm-hmm. you don't win everything. And you hit rock bottom very often. And you've got to say, I'm going to work myself through this. And that carries on into life, in business, in relationships. I don't know of any other way to learn those kinds of things, and I would like to think that I've passed that on to my children. And, you know, I think that it's a good piece of advice to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have to sort of keep it in perspective. You got to be very humble about this. You know, you have success, great. That means somebody else didn't. You know, you don't wear those things. Let other people congratulate you. You don't have to congratulate yourself. much easier to, you know, keep a low profile and just go about your business.
Sounds like very, very sage advice.
Now, when you get to be almost 69, that's what happens.
So you already told me about the transition between 68 and 72 and how your life changed and your training regimen changed a little bit. Can you talk about what some of the major comparisons are that you drew between 68 and 72 and maybe some of the major events of your participation in 72?
Well, the real difference for me was that I was now working, married, and about to have our first child. And that necessarily changes your focus. It's hard to devote as much time as you do to your sport when you have these other obligations and, you know, life is staring you in the face. You try the best you can to accommodate. You know, you work it out in a different way. You just make the best of it. Sometimes that worked, sometimes it didn't. I was fortunate. I was able to stay reasonably competitive, but I didn't have the chance to travel and compete in Europe, you know, between 68 and 72 like I had done before. I was living in Europe. Now I could go over maybe twice a year to competitions. And, you know, that was even tough. Competitions were on the weekend, so you leave. We used to leave New York on a Thursday night, get into wherever you were Friday morning. You had X numbers of hours to acclimate to the time change, and you were on the piste, 8 o'clock in the morning on Saturday. That's a difficult transition. So your results suffer. You don't get as much if you get knocked out early, you don't have as much chance to train against the top fences because you're eliminated. And it's difficult. And I mean, I enjoyed fencing very much. So to me, it was sad that I wasn't able to be as good as I thought I could be. But you do the best you can. And if there's somebody better out there, he'll knock he'll take your spot on the team. I was fortunate to be able to hold my own nationally, but internationally, I certainly suffered. Yeah. But that's what happens. Time to move on.
What was your biggest national win? What year was that?
I won the national championships in 69. It's terrible. I once had to do this. I was inducted into the U of P Hall of Fame, Athletic Hall of Fame, and I had to go back and find out what I'd won and what I'd lost. And it was just agonizing. I've got a box, literally a shoe box, where I have medals, and I had to keep flipping them over to see what the hell I'd won. I think I won 7 national team titles. I think I was a medalist as an individual, I don't know, 6 or 7 times, and I won one in 69. I won the Pan Ams in 71, the individual and the team. I had fun.
Yeah. So, anything that you'd like to tell us about 72 and the major experiences you had there?
I won't dwell on the obvious.
Right.
But I will. But there's a story related to the obvious. I'll tell you 2 stories about that.
Okay.
One is that, and I don't remember who the people were, the runners, but I was I did some sprint work. That was part of my training. Short, very short. Maybe, 30 yards. And I just had to, get up to as fast as I could. And there was a training track in the village. And the training track had a straightaway that ran tangent to the oval. So I would, nobody was there one afternoon. Most of the afternoons, and I would do my sprints, along the side. And you also have to understand that I'm very slow. And just to tell you about how slow I am, before I went to the 68 games, I went back to Penn to train with my old coach down there, and Franklin Field had a track. And so, part of my training was to do these sprints, and I had gone onto the track one afternoon, and I was doing these sprints, my normal idiot stuff. And after I finished and I was just sort of sitting around, 2 young high school kids came up to me and they said, what event are you in? I said, I'm not a track person. I'm a fencer. And they said, oh, thank God, because you are slow. Anyways, all right. So here is the 72. I'm still slow. And I'm still running these sprints. And the track was built at one end of it. It made its turn, and there was a hill. Just a grassy knoll, as it were. And lots of athletes, all from different countries, were all sitting up there. They'd either done their things, or they were getting ready, or they were just hanging out. There could have been 100 or so of them sitting up there, men, women, you name it. And I'm doing my sprints. And about, halfway into my sprint, I'm about as fast as I can possibly go. I'm blazing. And there are 2 guys on the U.S. team who are just warming up, and they're just jogging, They're in their sweatsuits, and I'm down to shorts and everything. And I'm busting ass, and they're just loping around, getting ready to do their stuff. And as I come tangent with them, the only part of their conversation that I hear is them saying, will you look at all that ass on that hill? And they passed me by as if they weren't. These guys were so much faster than I was that they could look, just pass me by. They could check out the world. I'm dying, and they're having a great time. Anyway, so that's one of my favorite experiences. The other thing is that was more important is that, as you may have heard, that when Avery Brundage called a one-day halt to the games in 72, and there was going to be a memorial service for everybody, all the athletes and the officials in the Olympics. And it was called for like 11 o'clock in the morning. And then there was a sort of word got around the village that the Soviets had banned their athletes from attending. Hmm. You know, this was their opinion that the Palestinians had certain rights and blah, so on and so forth. Fine. Most of us, everybody just walks in. There was not by team. You just, you know, you knew at 11 o'clock. And the stadium is filling up. And we're just about ready to have, you know, whatever speeches were going to be given. And all of a sudden, at the entrance to the track where we all walked in and filled in into the stands, we start to see Polish athletes, Hungarians, Romanians, some of the Russians. And what we subsequently found out was that the Soviets had changed their opinion and they had left it up to the conscience of the athletes themselves. There was no official ban. And all of these people were going against what they knew was the official thing. And as they started to, you know, come into the main area of where we were all sitting, everybody started to applaud them, because for them to do that took a lot of courage. Mm. Those were not easy times for Eastern Bloc athletes, and you know, they all had minders, every team, and that was a great moment, I thought, for the solidarity of athletes.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Well, before we close the interview today, is there anything else that you'd like to tell us about?
God, I've talked for so long. The only thing I would say is that it would be nice to see a continuation of athlete participation in the administration of amateur athletics in this country. It's a big job, and the USOC does a good job, but I you know, at the bottom, the people that are sweating it out, and when it's time for them to retire, and even if they've got the time when they're in their formative years, having them a part of the administration of what goes on and what affects the lives of so many athletes, I'd like to see that continue. I'm not au courant anymore with, you know, what's out there, but when I was training, there was a lot of people that sort of ran our lives, if you will, who were not necessarily athletes. And I think having more athletes, men, women, children, is a great idea. Mm-hmm. And I am incredibly astonished and pleased and thankful that we now have the Paralympics. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you. I belong to a tennis club in London, and we have a young man that had to lose his leg below his knee, and I guess he's about 16 now. He got fitted with one of those prosthetic legs, and I got to tell you, he runs around that court and can do anything that anybody else can do, and it's probably been true for many, many years, but unacknowledged sufficiently, and now is. You know, now they got all sorts of sports that everybody competes at, and I think that's fabulous, and that should be as promoted as heavily as, you know, the normal games. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really appreciate it. And I just appreciate you telling me your stories. They were wonderful.
I enjoy telling them. Thank you very much, Desiree. I hope your project is successful. I'm sure it will be. And I look forward to helping out if there's anything I can do in the future.
Oh, thank you so much, Steve. I'm going to...